Senate Committee on the Environment and Natural Resources. It's the 9th of February. And we have a very full agenda, several items to get through. We will not get through everything that's on the posted agenda for the day. We are going to start out with finishing the public hearing and on Senate Bill 1530. And then we're probably going to have a work session, but you know, we'll see if we're not going to have a work session if we don't have the votes, but I think we're going to have the votes. I'm anticipating that we will have the votes. So, and then we will be moving to the work session on 1574. And then we'll see where the clock is, and if time permitting, we will take up the work session on, or no, excuse me, public hearing on the septic system bill. And then we're still awaiting paperwork and amendments on 1517, the wetlands bill. We don't have, yeah, so we're going to carry over Senate Bill 1517, the wetlands bill. So if you're here for that, we will not be getting to it today. And I doubt that we will get to SJM 201 either. So with that, we are going to open up the public hearing on Senate Bill 1530, also known as the suction dredge bill. And we are going to, so where we left off this last, at the last meeting, we had a number of folks that hadn't been able to testify yet. And then we've also had some questions that have been asked by committee members and stakeholders. And so we're going to spend some time getting answers on those. So we're going to start out. I'd like Dave Honeycutt and Rich Angstrom and Marianne Nash, if the three of you could come forward. And I'll let you guys take it from there. Oh, and I do think that I don't know if our vice chair I think will be exercising his right as vice chair of this committee to swear in folks that are testifying in front of our committee today. I have a standard statement that I have read every single meeting where we have done this, and so I'm going to read that for the record, and so that everybody understands what their rights are. So Oregon's legislature is one of the most open and inclusive in the nation. We hold public hearings on each of our bills and seek input from the public in our committee process. We depend on the information provided to us by the citizens of Oregon. No one can tell us better how the laws we pass affect the people of our state. All we expect in return for your help is that you respect the members of this committee, respect the legislative process, and that you tell us the truth. Whether you are another member of the Legislative Assembly, the director of an agency, a lobbyist, or a member of the general public, we expect for your testimony to be truthful. However, I am concerned that the practice of swearing in witnesses will have a chilling effect on the willingness of everyday Oregonians to participate in the process of making their laws. For that reason, I want to address those of you planning on coming before this committee today. The vice chair of the committee is within his rights to swear you in. However, you have rights too. You do not have to swear an oath. You can walk away if you choose. You can choose to have an attorney present with you. You can avail yourself of your Fifth Amendment rights, including the right not to give testimony against yourself. And if you tell the truth, nothing you say to this committee, whether you have sworn an oath or not, can be used against you in any state proceeding. You should know, however, that this immunity does not extend to any federal legal proceeding that may be brought against you, including a federal criminal proceeding. If you testify under oath and do not tell the truth, you could be charged with the crime of perjury. Perjury is a Class C felony and carries a maximum possible sentence of 5 years imprisonment, a $125,000 fine, or both. It is up to the Marion County District Attorney, however, whether to proceed with any charges for perjury. So now that folks understand what the process is and what their rights are, and before we move to this panel, I believe the committee administrator will swear in.
Will you please raise your right hand? Under penalty of perjury, do you solemnly swear that the evidence you're about to give in the matter now pending before the Senate Environment and Natural Resources Committee shall be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, so help you God?
I do.
Go ahead.
Good afternoon. My name's Rich Angstrom. I'm the president of the Oregon Concrete Aggregate Producers Association. I'm here to testify on 1530. We are working on some aspects of it, so I'm going to withhold, you know, whether until we have a final determination on this bill, where we're at, because there's been some meetings today. But on the bill itself as written, we're not supportive of it. But before I go into that, I wanted to let the committee know that I have spent personally just a lot of effort going out, working with the various mining interests that this bill impacts that are not normal, the normal course of the OCAPA, under the OCAPA umbrella. I spoke at various meetings that they've had in the valley. I've met their the families. I've seen the grandparents that are out there with their families doing various mining activity. I see the clubs that they have. I see how they have been operating as a community. And in fact, I want to tell you from that experience, despite of what some of the things that are said in the building, this is a pretty good group of folks. It's a lot of families. It's a lot of kids. It's a lot of grandmas and grandpas. And I, you know, frankly, I was pretty impressed with what I saw as I went around the state speaking to them. With that said, my concern, the general concern that we have over this bill, is how it has expanded from its original roots. There's no question, and I think we've determined in today's discussions, in 2012, the state of California did a moratorium on placer mining. What happened is we literally had an influx of placer miners, suction dredgers, that came into the state, and we had quite a social conflict that was occurring out on the river. Some of these people were pretty rude. There's no question that they were blocking the rivers. And for other people's traffic, they were starting their operations up at early in the morning next to houses and causing all kinds of trouble just in the neighborhood. Since that time, in Oregon's moratorium, the numbers dropped back down from, I think it was like 1,500 or 1,200, something of that nature, and it's back around 400 suction dredgers in the state. But the initial bill started out as that social conflict. It expanded into an environmental conflict with the listed species, and that was fine. It then expanded into all of the federal permits that are patented and unpatented mining claims on federal ground. It expanded then into upland areas 100 yards from the waterways. It expanded to tribal areas. It's expanded a broader definition of waters of the state. And in the original bill, not the amendments we were talking about today, which I haven't had a chance to review, is it expands including every miner mining interest in the state of Oregon, including OCAPA, and that was Section 6, and I believe that section has been removed. So the history of this has been one of just continued expansion of the coverage and who it affects, and it swept in interests that were not part of that social debate that was going on the Rogue River. The bill has a couple of things that I want to just talk about so you know what we've been working on. And a couple of those provisions are, one thing that they do that's well is that they remove all of the upland placer miners out of this suction dredge debate and put it over in Dogami. There's quite a bit of question about how that's being done and working out the details of that, but I think we have pretty good progress on that particular point today. And in fact, right outside here, Rich Riggs from Dogami and I were talking at length about a threshold that makes sense so we can kind of scale how this will apply to the upland people. But if we look at the bill specifically, one of the things that caught our attention is how they use the word non-aggregate to regulate versus aggregate. An aggregate actually is just a kind of colloquialism, meaning a kind of a combination of a matrix of material. It could be a lot of things. In rule, Rich has pointed out that they do define aggregate as sand, gravel, and stone, but in statute it's not defined. And what's interesting about the way this was written is it's inclusive of every other element or compound that's not aggregate as far as how it extends the regulation, which is kind of an odd way of dealing with gold and silver is to call it anything other than aggregate, right? And so one of the things we pointed out is it just seems more straightforward to say small scale, placer, precious metals, or gold or silver, one of those kinds of options. The other thing that I want to point out is section 6. Well, hold it. On section 5, I want to go touch that for just a second. Section 5 says that any basically motorized mining upland will have to go through an operating permit through the Department of Geology and Mineral Industries. Their operating permit is set up to manage the size of mine sites that are greater than 5,000 cubic yards and 1 acre disturbance. Let me say it this way. Is the operating permits required of Dogami are for large-scale mines, Knife River, Wilder Sand and Gravel, Oldcastle Materials. And what this does is it takes even down to a guy using a mining drill, a drill, and augering will have to go through that same process. We think that is way overkill. Just absolutely unbelievable overkill to make miner that wants to go out and prospect and do some gold and silver mining that's using an auger to have to go through the same process my biggest members have to go through. Makes no sense. That makes no sense to us. So Section 6 created quite a problem, and we appreciate that. I think there's an agreement to remove that, but I did want to tell you the nature of that because there's been a lot of background noise. The issue with this is cultural resources are managed both through the federal government, the Historic Preservation Act, and they're managed through the local government process. It's a Goal 5 resource. Cultural resources is a Goal 5 resource, and we rely on the counties to do the permitting for that. The way this is written is it says the Department of Geology and Mineral Industries may deny or condition any permit. They can deny or condition any permit under 517-790, all the mines applicable. This one actually applies to every mine site in the state of Oregon, to ensure compliance with laws protecting these things, including cultural resources. The issue OCAPA has with this section one is we have agencies already regulating those. But the second thing is it says that Dogami can deny or condition an operating permit without talking about what the standard will be, what the criteria will be. There's a difference if it's an archaeological site where it's a grave site, or it's something like a spirit mountain where they went to have a spiritual quest, or any other historical cultural resources. So there's a big difference that needed to be fleshed out, and our objection there is a pretty important one. Is you're actually handing Dogami carte blanche approval ability to manage this without notifying the operators of what they have to do when they submit an application. We just think it's just unfair that it's written that way without more fleshing out in more detail. The other issue, and the last one I think I'm going to bring up and allow this to move forward with the other witnesses here, we're witnesses now, is the definition of small-scale mining removed plans of operation. Small-scale mining is only used in one section, in two sections in the ORS that we could find. And I think this is one of those points that was agreed to take out also this morning. But where it's used is like the Fish and Wildlife statutes that protect lawfully abiding hunters and fishers from basically being harassed by folks that want to interfere with their activity. That small-scale mining definition is used in that section, and it basically guts it from our perspective. And we don't know why, from just the mining industry generally, why that's the case. So with that, we have some pretty good concerns about this whole bill. There's more that's associated with it. But the one thing I would say, based on this morning's meeting, you do have some dash twos in front of you that I believe just literally came out before we got in here. And I haven't had a chance to review them, but it looks like most of those issues were addressed, except for the scale issue. And that is going to take a little more thinking on how we deal with the scale of a very, very small miner not running them through an oversized operating permit process that would be fair to them. So with that, Mr. Chair, thank you for the time to testify and go through some of the concerns and really kind of catch the committee up of where we're at in the discussions.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, Dave Honeycutt, Oregon Mining Association here in opposition to SB 1530. I haven't seen the Dash 2 amendments, so I don't know what are in those, but a lot of the concerns that Mr. Angstrom just set out on the record are concerns shared by the Oregon Mining Association. Let me go directly to Section 5. If you look at Section 5, Sub 1, I'm going to go into a little bit of detail, and the reason why is because based on the testimony that I heard on Wednesday, or I guess last Thursday, it seems to me that what the focus of the proponents of the bill was on in-stream, on the in-stream impacts on salmon and habitat and biological resource habitat. This bill goes far beyond in-stream and impacts not just upland areas, but also in some cases with Section 6, every mining claim that's been filed. And you can start on Section 5 on page 2 of the bill, lines 39 through 41. That section provides that, notwithstanding the yard and acre limitation, so this means it's going to apply to the small-scale folks, an operator that engages in non-aggregate placer mining within 100 yards of a water of the state is subject to the provisions of 517.702 to 517.989. 517.901 to 989, which this section makes applicable to, are the chemical mining provisions of Chapter 517. So in other words, if this bill were to pass, we would make the non-aggregate placer mining folks within 100 yards of the stream subject to the chemical mining provisions of 901 to 989. There are two possible permits in those sections that this bill makes applicable to the little guy within 100 yards of a water of the state. There is the operating permit provisions in 517.790. Those are the ones that apply, as Mr. Angstrom said, to a large aggregate mining operation, say a Knife River, a large size aggregate mine. And then there are the chemical permit requirements in 517.971, and those apply to surface mines that are going to use some provision other than some type of chemical provision. We're not sure, because of the breadth of the language, applying those provisions to these folks, whether or not they're subject to the operating permit requirements, which, as Mr. Angstrom said, is certainly overkill. There are significant requirements to obtain an operating Dogami operating permit, and why we would make someone that goes out with a hand drill 99 yards from the from a water of the state, which is broadly defined to include not just streams or not just things, but not just streams that have essential salmon habitat or biological resources, but essentially any water body in this state, why we would make the small guy go through that process and to obtain an operating permit from Dogami is, as Rich said, overkill. It's even worse if you look at the provisions of 517.971, the chemical mining requirements. Those require multi-agency coordination, a lengthy process. In fact, since those chemical mining provisions have been enacted, there have been only two applicants for permits under those, Calico out of Malheur County and Alamos Gold out of Lake County. Those permits are being processed now, but those are multi-million-dollar permits that take years to work their way through, and you've got a coordination between the federal agencies and multiple state agencies. Why we would consider applying that to the guy on with the hand drill on the weekend is beyond me. But essentially, that language alone will kill it. Plus, it will kill the opportunity for the small guy. Not only that, but the language, that language, adding the chemical mining provisions to the placer mining issue, conflicts with 517-954. 517-954, which is part of the chemical mining statutes, provides that it doesn't apply, that the chemical mining provisions don't apply to placer mining. So we have a specific section of the Oregon Revised Statutes that says that it doesn't apply to placer mining, and yet Section 5, subsection 1, requires placer miners to subject themselves to the chemical mining statutes. So I don't understand how that's supposed to work. And that's Section 5. As Rich said, there needs to be some kind of structured process for permit requirements so that the guy moving 5 yards of dirt with a hand drill 99 yards from the shore isn't subject to the same permitting requirements as either Calico Mine in Malheur County or Knife River on a large aggregate scale. So that needs to be fixed. Section 6 of the bill, which Mr. Angstrom also talked about, gives Dogami the ability to deny or condition an operating permit. That's an operating permit under 517-790. This section doesn't apply to the chemical mine permits, while Section 5 does. I don't know why they did that, but whatever. But that language in Section 6 applies to every mine application, not just the upland folks within 100 yards of a water of the state, not just the in-stream guys. Every single mining application in Oregon is subject to Section 6, which gives Dogami the ability to deny or commit or condition an operating permit as necessary to ensure compliance with laws protecting Native American burial places, but also archaeological sites or other cultural resources. They don't define archaeological sites. They don't define cultural resources. They don't give the bill doesn't give Dogami any indication at all as to what kind of process they're supposed to use to evaluate whether to approve or deny or to condition one of these sites. What if there's, what if there's a cultural resource on the corner of the property? Under this section, is Dogami supposed to approve the application? Are they supposed to deny the application? Are they supposed to condition approval of the application? That section doesn't say, and it gives no direction to Dogami to establish a procedural process. It doesn't tell you what laws there are that are protecting cultural resources, and there are multiple laws that protect cultural resources from both the federal government and from the state agencies. You have SHPO, State Historic Preservation Office, will have rules relating to cultural resources. You'll have the Columbia River Gorge Commission, which will have rules relating to cultural resources that would apply to a mine within the Gorge Scenic Area. You have LCDC with Goal 5 natural resource. That's the natural LCDC's Goal 5 is their natural resource goal. You have county regs that implement Goal 5 that have natural resource or have cultural resource provisions. So if Dogami, in trying to figure out which laws to apply and which laws don't apply, applies a particular law, it will affect not only the process they use, but it will also affect the rights, if you have any. This section doesn't say that whether you have any or not, but if you're the applicant for a mining permit, this and Dogami denies your mining permit, do you get a hearing? Where do you go to appeal? This section doesn't tell you, and the laws that they apply will affect where you go to appeal. If they make a contested case decision, you would appeal to the Oregon Court of Appeals. If they make a decision in other than a contested case, then you would apply to the circuit court for the county in which the property is located. Or if they decide that there are either LCDC or county cultural resources under Goal 5 that they're applying, then you would appeal to LUBA. Can we
bring it back to... We have the dash twos in front of us. I think we all know that we have the dash twos.
I haven't.
And you're talking about things that aren't like the dash twos would take care of all of this. And so
well,
I feel like you're starting to filibuster.
Mr. Chairman, you're
on a roll, and you know this area of the law well. And I appreciate that. But we also have the dash twos, which Senator Bates is going to explain, which I think addresses the last half hour of testimony. So
well,
that's why I'm just like, okay, I would like Senator Bates to explain, but I wanted to hear from you guys first.
Well, so. I appreciate that. I appreciate that, Mr. Chair. I haven't seen the dash two amendments, so I don't know what's in them and what isn't.
Yeah.
On, and I'll try and wrap up. On Section 9 creates a new definition of biological resource habitat, and one of the provisions or one of the definitions of biological resource habitat includes land habitat that's essential to bull trout. You'll find bull trout in in northern Malheur County, in Baker County, in Grant County. You folks passed a bill last session, House Bill 3089, which was designed to designate mining as a natural resource use, same as farming, agriculture, or forestry, and it was specifically designed to kickstart an industry in eastern Oregon. The mining industry is critical for eastern Oregon and would be an industry that they mine directly into our southern border in Nevada and do it very well. We have the same geology there. We could do it here. The language that includes bull trout would immediately impact mining in Grant County, Baker County, and Malheur County, in an industry, in an area that needs the jobs, where we're trying to kickstart a mining industry, and you folks said mining is welcome over there, this bill would take us a step back and hurt that process. Section 10 of the bill adds requirements and requires a miner, someone who's doing in-stream mining, to obtain a removal fill permit from DSL from rock one, okay, from removal material one piece. We talked about this in the wetlands bill that Ms. Nash and Farm Bureau bought. The farmers here had a legitimate complaint that the 50 cubic yard exclusion from the removal fill permit wasn't sufficient to enable them to keep their ditches clean. I totally agree with that. For the miners, which last session you said are on par with agriculture and forestry in House Bill 39, you're now going to pass a bill that says not only do they get they don't have a 50 cubic yard exception anymore, they have zero. And so you're taking one industry and saying it has no exception at all, when any other use would have the 50 cubic yard exception. And frankly, I agree with Farm Bureau that ought to be bounced up to 100 cubic yards. We'll save that argument for another day, but why you're treating mining differently from the other natural resource sectors, I don't know.
Mr. Chair?
Yep.
Can I get clarification? Dave, you lost me on this last part, because I always understood this was more of recreational activity. Now it seems like you're now talking about some type of industrial mining.
Well, Mr. Chair, Senator Brzezinski, no. What we're talking about is Section 10, which deals with the motorized in-stream mining, and the exception, the 50 cubic yard exception, should deal with the small guys. This bill takes that away for the placer miners. It doesn't take it away for any other folks, but it only applies and removes that 50 cubic yard exception for the placer miners, for the small guys. And so I'm struggling to figure out why that's in there. And then the last thing, and then I'll shut up and apologize for taking so much time, Mr. Chair. The last thing in Section 14, and again, these sections take effect in 2021, Sections 9 through 14, or 9 through 16. In Section 14, there are a significant number of limitations on in-stream placer mining. These are the sections that apply in-stream, not upland. those sections apply not just to privately owned land or state-owned land. They also apply to federal land. And as Mr. Engstrom said, you've got the real potential here for a preemption argument. The state has a role in regulating mining on federal land. The U.S. Supreme Court decided that in a case in the late 1980s. So the state has a role to play, but that role is limited. And for a lawyer, you've got a preemption argument. At some point, the federal government, with its rules and regulations, occupies the field. The federal government controls what goes on federal land. And to the extent that these regulations would essentially prohibit the federal government from issuing a mining permit on federal land, you've got a real preemption argument here. And at some point, it would seem to me that it would behoove the committee and the body as a whole to get an opinion from Ledge Council as to which ones, which provisions in Section 14 that would apply to federal land would trigger a preemption and a lawsuit. Why don't, you know, I understand the legislature can pass laws that are either preempted by federal law or unconstitutional. That's not unique to the Oregon legislature. Legislatures across the country and Congress do it with fair frequency. But it seems to me like it would behoove you to at least have that discussion and figure that out before you move forward with some of these provisions. With that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you for your presentation.
Chair Edwards, members of the committee, my name is Marianne Nash, here today on behalf of the Oregon Farm Bureau. And I can officially say I don't think I know anything about mining after hearing the testimony of the two folks before me. So I'm here today on a pretty narrow issue. We have some concerns about Sections 9 and 13 of the bill that direct, Section 13 directs DSL in cooperation with DEQ and ODF&W to designate a new type of habitat called biological resource habitat. Section 9 defines that as essential indigenous and anadromous salmonid habitat, which is already defined by statute, and then any habitat that's essential to the recovery and conservation of Pacific lamprey, bull trout, and freshwater mollusks. I looked at the dash ones and dash twos, and I think the dash ones attempt to take that definition out, but I don't think they actually remove the definition, so I apologize if I'm testifying on something that has been addressed in the amendments. But as you all were so gracious to hear last week, we have significant issues around removal fill laws already in terms of enabling farmers to clear drainage ditches and keep their properties maintained so that they can use them for agricultural use. A lot of those issues have focused around essential anadromous indigenous salmonid habitat, ESH, and the definition of ESH and where it applies and whether or not something is a jurisdictional or non-jurisdictional water for DSL. We've spent a lot of time and energy trying to resolve this issue with DSL, but it's a tricky one and there's no easy resolution. And until we achieve that resolution, we're really uncomfortable around expanding the definitions of special resource habitats that are protected into areas where they'd cover almost all of the state, because we haven't been able to reach resolution and ensure that farmers can maintain their drainage ditches in an easy manner. That was the subject of part of our bill for 1517 that you were so gracious to hear last week. And so we have concern about broadening that definition and including new types of habitat and having DSL do those designations. And so we have been working hard with DSL to address these issues, but we're not quite there yet. And so we'd like that definition to not be expanded at this point. So with that, I will conclude and take any questions.
Questions for the panel?
Yeah. Thank you. This is beginning to feel a little like extermination by a thousand regulatory cuts. And Mr. Engstrom, you carried through the progression pretty well, from basically a social conflict to a headwaters to the sea regulation. But I know that you have a education biology. I wondered if you would have an opinion as to the veracity of the, or not, of the harm that is alleged being done by these dredge miners to the habitat.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Whitsitt. in order to prepare for this debate over the last couple of sessions, I've read a number of the studies, including mercury studies, fish and wildlife studies. I've read biological opinions that have been coming out of the Forest Service. Whereas I haven't been a researcher out there on the site monitoring this. I've read a big body of the law or big body of the research that has been done. And the first thing I would say is it is important to manage these operations on the river. Let me give you a couple of examples of where I think the environmental community and the resource agencies have some legitimate concern, and then talk to you about where I think they may be overextending. During most of this mining in Oregon happens during the in-water work period for ODF&W, and it's usually those summer months. And it's designed to be where the fish aren't generally present when you're looking at essential salmonid habitat. But think about the Klamath, which I think the center could appreciate. When you have in the fall a bunch of the fish moving up, where they're going into is the cold water refugia. They're finding the mouths of the creeks. They're finding the deep pools. They're finding wherever they can cool off. And I believe that the lethal temperature is about 72 degrees where you really start losing the salmon. And so these fish are seeking out those places. You can see the suction dredge miners, if they're not regulated, moving through those areas and displacing those fish and creating a very stressful environment for them. I also agree that you can put so many placer miners on the river, which I think might have been some of what we experienced in 2012, where the cumulative impacts are pretty significant. And then the third thing is for sure we don't want them rolling over the top of the spawning beds when the fish are spawning, right? That's just unconscionable even. So, and I can go on. There's other things that I think are legitimate discussions to have. On the other side is to look at what Oregon does as far as its regulatory environment and its response, and really focus in on how we're minimizing impacts to these fish by only allowing these operations to happen during summer months when the fish aren't present in the streams. There's some tightening that probably could go along with that. But I believe, after reading that, and I want to say one other thing. I have read a big body of the fish and wildlife research, and there's a large number of research that says there's no effect. And there's some cases that are pretty good, some research examples where there is effects. So it's a spread. The scientific community has not come to a firm conclusion that there's an effect or not effect, and every researcher seems to have a little bit of their own opinion and some conjecture that goes along with it. But after looking at it, I think the body of the case is really kind of where ODF&W laid out, that there are risks, but if it's managed appropriately, those risks are reduced. But to carry that on is we can have a conversation where the mining community would sit down and say, yeah, those are legitimate issues and legitimate concerns, and we need to manage the regulatory response around that. It's a different thing to say, we're just going to ban and stop it and not have an appropriate regulatory response that protects the species. And that's what this bill does. And that's where, we have some objection, legitimate objection, to kind of cutting off a thoughtful discussion and debate about how to manage these operators in a way that's not harmful to these species by just saying, we give up, we're just going to do a ban. And I just think that's unfair. The citizens of Oregon are getting punished because of an influx of folks coming in from California that were a bunch of bad operators. And I'll say it again, I've been out. These are good people. They're trying to do the right thing. And not to allow them to have that legitimate discussion about what is the best way to do it. Maybe there are sections we need to take off because they're sensitive habitats for the fish. Let's have that discussion. But let's just not throw our hands up because it's easy, expedient, or political and say, we're not even going to have it. We're just going to ban you from any waters of the state that's associated with a biological resource habitat, which is significant and substantial.
I'd like to get Senator Bates up here to explain what the amendments do. I appreciate the input. I appreciate the question. Senator Bates does have some other things. He's been waiting patiently. He's going to explain the amendments, so I think that'll help move this committee along. So Senator Bates, if you could come forward and bring with you whomever you think is best to help, perhaps legislative counsel and representative from the department or from Dogami, one of the departments. If you could walk us through the dash, we talked about the dash one amendments at the last committee hearing. The dash two amendments, I know, address some of the concerns that were raised here today. Perhaps you could present those and how we got here.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Alan Bates, State Senator from Southern Oregon. I'll walk through a part of this with you, and then I'll ask Dogami and LC to walk through the rest of it for you, because it's pretty technical, and I want to make a mistake and say the wrong thing and tell you that I was supposed to be at another meeting at 3 o'clock. I've got to be there by 4, so I'll give as much as I can. We had Rich Engstrom and others come to us this morning for the first time to discuss issues in the bill that they were concerned about, and they fell into two broad categories. One was the Section 6 you've heard about, which was something the tribes had asked for. This concerns primarily the lamprey, the Pacific lamprey, and it also was about what they thought were things were culturally appropriate and important to them. And that's what that section was about. I went back and rechecked with them today. They are willing to pull that language and just continue with the present protections they already have. They would have liked to have this, but they are feeling that it's much more important that the Pacific lamprey be protected, which this bill does. And for that reason, they're willing to make that compromise and pull it out. Most of the upland part of this bill was brought in because we wanted to lift the moratorium that is presently in place on recreational miners in the upland region. It clearly proved that no good deed goes unpunished. So we tried to lift that. We also put language in that Dogami had asked for simplification and better understanding of it. Some of that has been clearly misunderstood. We have a verbal information from the Department of Justice that the interpretation that you've heard today is not correct. This is I'm not saying anybody's lying, and I'll take the oath to. It's a matter of interpretation that they've misunderstood it. LC has told us this morning they misunderstood it, and Dogami told me this morning they misunderstand this. And because of that misunderstanding, they were quite agitated and concerned about it. As a result of that conversation this morning, we tried to make it even clearer that this bill in upland area is not trying to make any significant change in commercial mining. It does lift the ban on recreational mining, and that means you can't use mechanized equipment to mine in upland areas. But you can still work there as a recreational individual, including, I think someone suggested you could have 500 people there with a pick and a shovel, and they'd be fine. And the permitting they have to get is minimal. It's not the expensive and very difficult one to get this there for commercial miners. So I'm going to stop there. I'm going to ask my colleagues to the left, or whatever, I guess you're not my colleagues.
Perhaps Maureen, maybe you could run
I want
through.
You to walk. I'd like them to walk through the technical part of how we fix this
particularly,
bill.
Particularly, I mean, we know that Section 6 has been removed, and then you shortened the reference in Section 5 on the 517 point. Blah, 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 and you shortened the range of statutes that it refers to make it clear that the chemical mining statutes do not apply. Could you walk us through that?
Mr. Chair, before Maureen gets started, Dr. Bates, if you don't mind, you said that recreational miners are exempt. They can still mine, but the motorized miners are still under the moratorium. Is that correct?
Recreational motorized mining is not allowed. And there's a moratorium now to stop anything from mapping those areas. We felt that was unfair and wanted to open it back up to recreational people. Motorized, and I be careful because it's really complicated. We start talking about motorized mining and what you're getting into small operations, big operations, and non-motorized. So I want to be careful here. But there was no intention in this bill in large commercial operations to affect them at all in any significant way. We were trying to lift the moratorium and get some clarity. And so I'd like to have them take that off for you.
One follow-up question.
Yeah.
How much of an expansion in area and river miles is this bill? We seem to have difficulty getting maps to show us that. So could you explain how much more we're going to include?
As we said in the dash ones, we'll know that much better when we get the actual, Mr. Chair, Senator Olson, I'm sorry. We will know that much better when we get the actual mapping from the Department of Development and Quality. I think it's going to be significant but not overwhelming, and we'll give you the exact numbers on those later on, but we won't have those right away. It'll take a couple of years to put those together. Remember, this is still under the moratorium, and we have 17 to come back, and probably I would expect it'll take a year or two to actually figure that out before this really takes effect because we don't have that information right now.
Thank you.
Maureen, Chair.
Yes, Senator Edward, Chair Edwards and members of the committee. So Senator Edwards gave an accurate summary of what the Dash 2 amendments do, first talking about the mining laws reference in Section 5 of the bill. As has been discussed during testimony, the reference in the base bill is to ORS 517702 to 517989. And I want to make clear that the way in which the mining laws are structured, that is essentially a general reference that is used in numerous places within the Oregon statute to refer to the mining laws generally. The mining laws are then structured to be further split into smaller series that address different types of mining. And when you actually read the statutes in relation to one another, it makes clear that placer mining is not subject to the chemical process mining statute. So therefore, the reference that was in the base bill, given that reading of all the statutes together, is a correct reference. It is also a correct reference to change it in the manner that it has been changed in the Dash 2 amendments to not reference the chemical mining statutes, to reference the shorter statutory series of 517702 to 517951. And so that change was made to make more clear that someone who is required to get a permit under Section 5 of this bill would not be subjected to the much more stringent consolidated permitting process that applies to chemical process miners. And then again, it's, as has already been stated, Section 6 of the bill is removed in the Dash 2s, as is Section 8. And Section 8 was a piece of definitional cleanup for Dogami that made a change to the definition of small-scale mining in ORS 517-120.
Did you say your name for the record?
Oh, excuse me. My name is Maureen McGee, and I'm a deputy in the Office of Legislative Counsel.
Okay. Thank you for the explanation. Before Senator Bates leaves, because you're going to have to leave before we wrap up this panel, I think, I want to thank you for bringing these amendments. I know that these amendments do not address some of the most fundamental issues about whether suction dredge mining ought to be allowed in rivers and streams in Oregon at all or not. And there are polar opposite opinions on that issue. But I do think, though, that at least these amendments address some things that just seem to be perhaps a little confusing or perhaps unnecessary to accomplish the objectives, your objectives, and the objectives of some of the advocates of the bill. And so I thank you for taking care of those on a tight timeline. So, okay. Questions for Legislative Council about the details of the amendment before we go to the department? Okay. So Before we go to the department, I think that Senator Olson, you'd like the department sworn in. Yep. Okay.
Can you please raise your right hand? Under penalty of perjury, do you solemnly swear that the evidence you're about to give in the matter now pending before the Senate Environment and Natural Resources Committee shall be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, so help you God?
I do.
Go ahead.
Thank you, Chair Edwards. Again, Richard Riggs from Dogami, Assistant Director. And I did receive questions from the last hearing on Thursday till today. I'm happy to address those right now on the record if you like. I did send an electronic copy, and I believe all the members did receive that electronic copy. And those questions were from Senator Olson. So if you would like, I could cover those or not.
Well, first, I thought he was going to cover some things that Dr. Bates had talked about.
Chair Edwards, Senator Olson, I believe both Legislative Council and Dr. Bates have very clearly explained the Dash 2 amendments, and I really don't have anything else to add, but I am happy to answer questions if you do have
any. Well, then shoot on the questions we have.
Absolutely. Chair Edwards, Senator Olson, on February 5th, I did receive questions from Senator Olson's office, and I have provided electronic copies of those my answers to that testimony. I'm sorry, to those questions. The first question is whether, I'll just read it verbatim. Fiscal impact defining two FTEs that you had that you would move to implement this work, are these FTEs paid for by someone else? And so my answer on that is the MLR program is 100% supported by other funds and receives no federal funds or state general funds. MLR revenue comes from fees associated with mining and oil, gas, and geothermal permits, the administration of DEQ water quality, Water Pollution Control Facility 1000 permits, and the National Pollution Discharge Elimination System 1200A permits, and reimbursement from applicants under the chemical process mining statutes pursuant to ORS 517-973. All of our positions are supported by this wide variety of revenue streams that come into the program, and no single source of revenue supports just one position. The second question has to do with the fiscal to the agency, and I did discuss this quite a bit at length, and I apologize that I am still unable to provide a certain fiscal because the number of applicants is still unknown, but I did provide some assumptions in my answer here. and the worst case scenario, we know there are 1,531 WPCF 600 holders. The WPCF 600 permit is a DEQ permit that is required for small-scale mining operations that use evaporation or seepage back into the ground for their process water. And we believe that this is the universe of potential applicants, but it could be some subset less of that. 1,531 is the upper bound, we believe, of potential applicants, but we believe it is well less than that. So assuming worst case that all 1,531 applicants do come forward, each field staff that I have handles approximately 300 mine sites per biennium. So if we round 1,531 to 1,500, we would need an additional 5 field staff if we were to take in 1,500 new applicants, and that would be for the duration that we hold those 1,500 new applicants. We would also need permit coordinators to handle the administrative side of that. And for every 500 permit applications, we would need one additional permit coordinator, and that's for the application. And then once we get past the application phase, and it would be one permit coordinator for every 1,000 new permits. And so we would, for the long term, once we've passed the application phase, would be 1.5 additional FTE in the permit coordinator. Assuming worst case that we needed to add 5 additional field staff, that would be approximately $352,500 as an impact. Again, that is the worst case. We anticipate it to be far less than that. And even if we were to be required to hire those 5 field staff, those positions would be entirely supported from the other funds that we receive from the fees that those positions, that those permittees would pay, and not from general fund and not from state or federal fund.
I'm going to need a little more fleshing out on the 305 employees for $350,000. That doesn't work out very well on a 2-year biennium. So are you talking about?
Chair Edwards Center, so that would be per year. Okay. So per biennium would be approximately $700,000 then.
And that's for the rest of this for the rest of this biennium, and then what would it roll up to roughly?
So for the if they came forward, probably about July of the biennium starting. So if the rest of the biennium would be about $350,000 for the remainder of the biennium, 1 year, and then for the next biennium it would be almost $700,000 for if we had to add five additional field staff. But again, we do not anticipate that. That is the worst case scenario where 1,500 applicants come out of the woodwork.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, could I offer one? Am I allowed to ask Elsie a simple question, which I hope is going to be a simple question?
Yeah.
This morning we discussed our desire to lift the moratorium on recreational mining in uplands areas, and you did a nice diagram of that for us. Because we really were trying to strike something that would work for everybody to a certain degree, not everyone's going to agree. What exactly does the bill do as far as lifting the moratorium on small recreational miners?
So, Chair Edwards, members of the committee, Senator Bates. So the bill, and this is the base bill and not changed by the -2 amendments, it lifts the moratorium on miners that are engaging in mining within the area that is between the ordinary high water mark and 100 yards upland. So right now, anyone who's conducting mining in that area, regardless of the size, if they're engaging in placer mining for precious metals, they're subject to the moratorium. And what Senate Bill 1530 does, and this is in section 2 of the bill where you will find this, is it lifts the moratorium on those folks. And for 1 year between now or between the effective date of the act, the lifting of the moratorium has an emergency clause. So between the effective date of the act and January 1st, 2017, people that are operating in that area will be subject to the requirement that they may only operate between the hours of 9 a.m. and 5 p.m. And there's a Class A violation attached to violation of that provision. That is identical to the requirement that was placed on upland miners under Senate Bill 838. So that's kind of the stopgap measure that would be in effect until January 1st, 2017. And then, as has been discussed, on January 1st, 2017, Section 5 of the bill would kick in such that miners who are operating between the ordinary high water mark and 100 yards upland and who are using motorized equipment for the purpose of site preparation or excavation would be subject to operating permit requirements from DOGAMI. If the miners are not using motorized equipment for the purpose of site preparation or excavation, they would be subject to no permitting by any state agency.
Thank you. Thank you, Senator Bates, for your work on the bill and for presenting the amendments to us. And you have to get going to another meeting.
Can I make one comment to Dr. Bates?
Yeah.
Dr. Bates, the other day there was a gentleman in here and he held up this document, scientific document, and he waved it around, said it was important. It says this is why there's a problem. But the interesting thing he didn't get to, and this is why I wanted to get this to you, the conclusion that this document that he gave me came to said, where managers determine that unstable dredge tailings may lead to unacceptable effects on spawning success, these effects could be reduced or eliminated through regulation that require that tailing piles be redistributed to restore the original bed topography and particle size distribution. So this says the reds can be moved around, but it also gives you a conclusion on how to solve it. And I think that would be the best way to do this bill.
Mr. Chair and Senator Olson, that would probably has that is a possibility that might work for salmon, stillet, and bull trout. Unfortunately, lamprey are there year-round, and they're in different stages of development, so it probably wouldn't work for lamprey, but I'm not that knowledgeable, but I will look into that.
Thank you.
Thank you for bringing it up.
Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
And while the department is still here, do you have a question for, let's say, council?
Follow-up for Dugami, actually. Just doing a little quick math.
Really quickly, does the, because I know legislative council has other work to be doing at this time of the session, but do you have other questions for legislative council?
Oh, hundreds.
Okay. Why don't you feel free to,
thank you, Maureen.
To go, Maureen.
On, okay. On your proposed fiscal, I know I realize worst case scenario and so forth, but the math doesn't work because the average state employee is currently, according to DAS, making $91,000 a year, and the mean is $87,000. And your estimate for 500 employees would be $70,000 a year. So what would be the qualifications of those people that are supervising 300 permits?
Chair Edwards, Senator Woodson, if I may. The field staff, I assumed an NRS 3 step 2 position with salary and OPE is approximately $70,500 a year. Even though I'm sworn in, I stand by that math. I was a mathematician as an undergraduate, so I believe that those numbers are correct. I can I did bounce them off my chief financial officer to make sure, and there was no dissent with those numbers.
I'm sure
either.
That your numbers are correct, sir. I was just wondering what the qualifications are of the person that you're going to hire to do this. I mean, what level person is going to be? Are these biologists or are these?
Chair Edwards, Senator, what's it? They would be geologists, NRS-3 series classification, which is the natural resources specialist. NRS is, I believe, natural resource specialist. And currently that specialty goes from a 1 to a 5, and these would be step NRS-3, so in the middle of that range, from 1 being entry level to 5 being a nationally known expert. And I have a mix right now on my staff of NRS-3 and NRS-4, and at one time I did have an NRS-2, but that position is currently vacant.
Appreciate it.
Mr. Chair?
Yeah.
Mr. Riggs, just out of curiosity, that 70,000 number that you mentioned, and I'm not looking at your math, does that include all benefits?
Chair Edwards, Senator Olson, yes, sir, it does. It's salary and OPE.
Thank you very much. Yes. Thank you. Appreciate it.
And Chair Edwards, I did have there was a third question that Senator Olson did, if I may just finish real very quickly. And there was a question about does Senate Bill 1530 give you enough guidance to provide a new set of rules? And I believe it does. And assuming the passage of Senate Bill 1530, and I wrote this answer before the -2 amendments came out, but it really the -2 amendments should not have any significant impact on this. But assuming the passage of Senate Bill 1530, the MLRR rules associated with exclusion certificates will need to be updated. Senate Bill 1530 clarifies problems that have arisen due to the passage of House Bill 3563, which was our fee bill that industry supported last session. Current statutory language requires all mine activity below the thresholds of 517.750 to apply for an exclusion certificate. And there's no bottom on that threshold. So even the very small miners that are out there with a pick and shovel would have to apply for an exclusion certificate. And that was when we discussed this with Department of Justice, and that was their interpretation as well. An exclusion certificate is, Senate Bill 1530 simplifies the administration of the exclusion certificate since all miners that are non-motorized for site preparation excavation techniques would be exempt. And you did hear Senator Bates say that those that universe of miners would not have to apply to us. So if they're not using motorized excavation techniques, we do not regulate. Those are hobby miners as far as we're concerned. We regulate commercial activity. We don't want to get into the business and have that expansion of government over those hobby miners. And that is so we believe this bill gives us enough information, and we would have to do rulemaking. We recognize it. But since a large population of miners would be exempt under a rulemaking, we don't think that rulemaking would be controversial and should go through fairly simply.
Thank you. We're going to call forward next.
Thank you for answering my questions. I really appreciate that.
You're welcome, Senator, and Chair. We're Senator Nelson. Anytime there's questions about dog AMA, I'm happy to come forward.
And I'm sure lots of more opportunities in Ways and Means where the costs get scrubbed.
Yes, sir.
DEQ, ODF&W, and DSL, those three agencies and their representatives come forward. I think Senator Olson had some specific questions.
Yes.
And he'll be exercising his right to swear you in.
Please raise your right hand. Under penalty of perjury, do you solemnly swear that the evidence you're about to give in the matter now pending before the Senate Environment and Natural Resources Committee shall be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, so help you God?
Yes,
I do. Thank you.
So why don't we start with
ODFW.
Why don't you just ask away.
Who wants to do who's ODFW? Could you introduce yourself, please?
Chair Edwards, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Russ Stoff. I'm the Rogue Watershed Manager for the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife. My office is in Central Point, Oregon, on the Rogue River.
Ooh, wow, you lucky dog, you. man, can we fix that? We got to get him back to sales. Thank you very much for your time and to answer the questions. And when we did Senate Bill 838, one of the things that was very interesting to me was the fact that we didn't call ODFW to testify. So could you testify as to the impacts that ODFW thinks might happen or might not happen?
Chair Edwards, Senator Olson, I've brought the testimony that I wrote for Senate Bill 838 in the 2013 session. We submitted that, but you're correct, we weren't called to testify on that. I can summarize that if you like, or I can read it verbatim.
Well, summarize.
Follow up. Yeah, we need to summarize, but follow up. There was one letter that we got from ODFW said that really they weren't concerned about the impacts because of the fact that they were in the window of time when salmonoids weren't in there.
Chair Edwards, Senator Olson, with all due respect, I don't think we meant to convey that we weren't concerned about it, but we did express our opinion that fish can withstand the occasional impact from suction dredge mining. However, there were some concerns that we had that we put forward in that testimony. And the concerns that we had essentially were that there is no method to evaluate or to limit the amount of suction dredge mining on a given stream. So when we saw a great increase in numbers of suction dredge activity in 2010, 2011, thereabouts, we saw stream reaches that had maybe 30 or 40 of these operating on a stream reach where there might have only been three or four previously. So we had concerns about the level of impact, and we feel that the impact is probably largely one of scale, like many disturbances that we see to streams and fish habitat. The other concern that we had was that there was no real mechanism to evaluate cumulative effects, and I sort of generalized that in the testimony. But there's sort of two categories of cumulative effects for us. One is just the aggregated effects of disturbances and activities that may impact fish, whether eggs were sucked up or, whether fish were disturbed. And there's also impacts to the stream fluviogeomorphology, so the stream function. As somebody testified, I think, last week, streams have a natural equilibrium with their channels and the sediment transport and the gravel movement in them that occurs at flood levels, and there's a certain equilibrium outside of flood levels, and that can be disturbed by any activity that digs up substrate in the stream. And it's unknown what effect that has from suction dredge mining, but we identified that potentially is a concern in the context of cumulative effects. And then the final concern that we expressed in our testimony for 838 in 2013 was that there's issues with enforcement of both DSL, fill removal law, and DEQ's clean water, in that the statutes surrounding that were written such that law enforcement officers can't issue citations of violations. They have to issue misdemeanors that would go through the district attorney's office in a local court. And unlike traffic tickets or fish and wildlife violations, where an officer has the discretion to issue a citation of violation that doesn't go through the DA. So it's really set up a situation where there's not that first level of enforcement where somebody can get a ticket. And that's, while many of the miners in our experience and our observation are very conscientious, we have some that aren't.
Follow up? Thank you. You're very knowledgeable, and I really appreciate this. One of the things that this report that was waved at me the other day, which I had to read, says in there that in the study, they did a study of the Scott River 11 kilometers, and they said that typically fish exhibited no strong preference for either substrate as long as there was adequate substrate that was untouched compared to the tailing, so they would go either way. Do you agree with that opinion?
Chair Edwards, Senator Olson, I believe the study that was handed in was the effects of suction dredging on streams, the Harvey and Lyle paper, is that correct?
Yes.
I'm very familiar with that paper. There's not a short answer to your question. I think that can be generally true. I think there are situations in smaller streams in the Rogue where coho salmon are present where there might be a limit to the spawning gravel that's available. And so there could be a risk of fish spawning on tailings. So the authors were speaking about suction dredge activities leaving tailings behind their operation, fish spawning on those. Generally what we see is that if there's not a shortage of spawning gravel, fish will not tend to spawn on those tailings. But there are situations where there are shortages of gravels and that could pose an issue.
So this will be my last question for this gentleman. So basically what we did, and I understand the importance of it, and it was a social issue. We had a lot of miners come from California and jump into our rivers and have their way with them, if you will. But as we get back to normal, where we have our normal miners that come out there, our 800 permits or whatever permits we have now, don't you believe that there could be a meeting of the minds such that we don't want to abuse our rivers and put all the miners in one place, which is probably where the gold is, but if we could come up with regulations to spread them out, move them around, make certain if we have narrow streams that maybe only one guy could go in there so that the fish still had opportunity to spawn but not on tailings, the bigger stretches and stuff like that, you know, spread them out as one bill wanted to do, spread them out a little farther and things like that. Don't you think that would be a good solution to allow, at least allow our miners to still mine but yet still protect the fishery? And the reason I'm going to preface this, because when this first came forward, it was all about anadromous species. And we found out that, oh, they're not on the water when they're there. So we ended up incorporating lamprey. So that always gives me skepticism when we have to add to make our argument better. So back to my question, don't you think if we could come up with a rule to spread these guys out, minimize the impact, but still allow them to do that?
Chair Edwards, Senator Olson, I would offer first that in my 23 years on the Rogue, I've seen as gold prices have fluctuated due to recession or other economic activity, that's really what we've seen drive the amount of participation. And I'm unsure what level of the increase in participation we saw in 2009, 2010 was solely due to Californians coming up. A lot of it, I think, was probably due to the increased price in gold. Generally, we rely on the commission and other policymaking bodies to negotiate the social solutions to these issues. So it's difficult for me to answer your question. I think there are regulatory mechanisms that can, as we've stated in our testimony, minimize the impacts to fish.
Go ahead.
I thought you were wrapped up.
Oh, I'm sorry. He mentioned that legislative body. That's why we like the guys that get their hands dirty, because you know what's out there better than we. And so it's nice to ask the question of you to get your opinion as to what you thought could do to fix that. I'm sorry, Mike.
No. Thanks. Senator Olson touched on something that that I was interested in asking and will further ask, and that is, the issue of the lamprey and the mollusks. Why is it important that we watch out for them? I mean, I know that, for Native Americans, their first food, there's that, but why are they of concern, Russ?
Chair Edwards, Senator Dembro, Pacific lamprey have only recently, say in the last 10, 15 years, 20 years, have really come to the attention of fisheries managers and largely due to tribal interests, but others. And historically, Pacific lamprey were a very abundant species in our anadromous streams. They were distributed upstream in the Snake as far as Nevada. They were, they were present everywhere that Chinook were present. They were a dominant food source for Native Americans and many others. And so they've been a large part of the ecology and the human structure, I guess. And so I think that's why they're so important. They're also very unique, and I'll keep this brief, but they're a very complicated ancient fish with very complex life history characteristics. For instance, they're anadromous like salmon and steelhead are, so they return to freshwater to spawn, spend their adult years in the ocean where they're parasitic on fish. When they turn to freshwater as an adult, they bury them, so they'll return in April, May, maybe early June. They'll move upstream some distance, bury themselves in the substrate, and then they'll emerge the following spring to spawn. And then after they build reds, or nests, rather, like salmon do with their eggs in them. And there's videos of this on YouTube, some of them taken by my staff. And if you're interested, I would encourage you to check it out. When the eggs hatch, they're larvae. They're not juvenile. And the larvae will distribute downstream and be present in the stream for 3 to 7 years before they metamorphose into a juvenile and go out to the ocean. So they're much more difficult to manage to avoid impacts to than salmon and steelhead, where we can put an in-stream work period on them that we can time it such that the juveniles are out of the gravel, they're free swimming, they can avoid disturbance. And in a nutshell, I think that's the best overview I could give, Senator Denbrough.
I'd like to move on to questions. If you had questions of DSL or DEQ, Senator Olson.
I do. Thank you. Well, I guess that I was expecting to see Palmer up here. Senate Bill 1530 increases the lands and waters that will be off limits. Do you have any idea what the acreage and we don't seem to be able to pin it down, and I find it very difficult as a legislative body to say that we agree with this when we might take up half or hold the whole state, put it off limits. And I wondered if you had an answer to that.
I understand. For the record, Karen Tarno with the Department of Environmental Quality, and Chair Edwards and members of the committee, Senator Olson. I think I might finally have some pictures to show and some stories to tell.
Karen,
the mapping,
before you go forward, we don't. So we actually don't have time for a 20-minute PowerPoint today. So
just show us the map.
I'm going to jump to the pictures.
Yeah, a map. If you could get to a map just to directly answer his question, that would be great.
That would be great.
Otherwise, we will recess this hearing while we do our next work session, and we will come back. We're going to get through both of them today, but we do have two bills that we will be working today. So
great. I will jump right to the maps. I've got four that I would show you. The first one, there is a handout on this, and it's on OLIS. So the first one I'm going to jump to is slide number six. Senator Olson, one of the questions that you asked was about water quality limited streams. This is a picture right now of the streams that are listed for sediment, toxics, and turbidity. The dark ones are currently listed, and the light red ones will be listed as of next year. Currently, it's very unlikely that a suction dredger could get a permit to dredge on these rivers. I'll just leave it at that. The next picture is slide number 11. So this is the moratorium water. And I'll show you this, and then I'll show you also Senate Bill 1530 and the Dash 1 amendments. And just to preface it, when I talk about river miles, it's going to be in ranges. When you're doing computer mapping, there's different base layers that you can use. And as it turns out, our agencies sometimes use different base layers. And what we've been doing in this mapping is pulling all of our agencies' information together. So it's not perfect yet, but I can give you ranges that are pretty telling. This is the moratorium. The blue represents the waters that would be affected. And the red are the locations of mining locations that were identified by people who applied for our permit in 2015. So it's about 350 permits, and it's about 900 locations. The river miles represent between that are affected by the moratorium are about 15% to 30% of river miles in the state. And out of about 900 permits, that got cut off. It's close to, it's just under 300 permits would be, or excuse me, 300 of the 900 mining locations would be affected by the moratorium, roughly. I don't remember the number exactly. If you jump to Senate Bill 1530, and this is the base bill, This map shows all the different kinds of restrictions and prohibitions, and we can make available an online map that kind of lets you see them on or off in layers if you're interested in that. The prohibitions and restrictions in this map represent about 32% to 42% of the waters in the state. And it really, in terms of the number of those mining locations that are affected, it's pretty much the same as are affected by the moratorium. That they're just within a few.
So I've got a question for you, if you don't mind, Mr. Yeah. Chair. You said that 15th, on the other slide, you don't have to go backwards, but I believe you said 15% to 30% of those river miles were affected by 838, and now you said that this affects an additional 42% of our rivers, or 42% total?
The first was 15 to 30. This is 32 to 42. So this affects more river miles, but about the same number of the mining locations that we have mapped.
The same number of the mining locations, but tributaries, is that how I understand?
Not quite tributaries.
Described to me shorthand.
It's a little bit apples and oranges, but
okay.
And then the if I can jump to the last one, the dash one, all this colored area and the colored lines would be moratorium waters by the dash one. The dash one adds lamprey, which captures some of the more downstream parts of the rivers that weren't affected in the moratorium or BRH or the bill. And also it basically goes from the lowest area of spawning all the way up into the watershed. So it's quite extensive. And I was not able to get a number that made any sense in terms of the number of mining locations that would be affected by this approach, but clearly it's
everybody.
Most of them.
It's got to be everybody.
Yes.
So the follow-up, sorry. The white area is essentially areas without rivers.
It's the closed basins. And
yeah. Yes. So it appears that every body of water in our state is off limits. Am I correct in that statement?
I'd say it's probably in the 90% range, but I don't have the math on it.
So we've gone from 15 to 30% to 90%.
With that dash one amendment.
With the dash one amendment. Pretty substantial. Thank you. I'm done.
With your questions
One other question for DEQ. What is the fiscal for you guys?
Yes, Chair Edwards and Senator Olson. Our fiscal is one position, be a generally funded position, an NRS3. Although we do anticipate permit fees, our permitting program is not fully fee funded, and we anticipate with the implementation of Senate Bill 1530, as in some form or another, we'll have probably fewer people applying for permits. And we also, with expectations about more coordination with the federal agencies, and also with the Dogami permitting program and their need for our input on those to ensure that their operating permits are protective, we see some other staff time in that. So the request is for one general fund position.
Follow up question then, if everything's off limits, how can anybody mine?
Actually, that fiscal was based on the Senate Bill 1530. Actually, it was based on both the bill as introduced and the dash one. You're very right. There are very few places where people can suction dredge mine under this scenario, but we would still be involved with the upland mining and interaction with the feds.
Thank you. And then for DSL, thank you, sir. What is your fiscal implications for yours? Because it seems like in this bill you're going to be passing off a bunch over to somebody else, ODFW, and does that mean you're going to reduce your budget?
So, Senator Edwards, Chair Edwards, sorry, Senator Olson. I'm, for the record, I'm Bill Ryan, Assistant Director of the Department of State Lands. And so the department currently does not devote a lot of resources to the permitting administration and the regulatory the enforcement behind the general authorization that we issue for section dredge mining. And so currently we use less than a half FTE of support staff, administrative staff, and less than 5% of an FTE of a technical staff to engage in enforcement. We basically do a couple weekends of enforcement with OSP during the summer season to, you know, spot check areas and then respond to specific complaints. That's about it. And the department doesn't receive any revenue in issuing the general authorization. And so we don't really anticipate much of a fiscal at all in terms of the implementation of the program moving forward.
Well, so you folks are kind of out of business then, aren't you? Because you don't need to go out and look anymore because there's nobody out there doing this. I do have one question, though. On biological,
wasn't a follow-up.
I know. It was. Biological habitat, it's already defined in the bill. Is there any other reason why you need to get involved with defining biological habitat?
Chair Edwards, Senator Olson. So in a follow-up to your follow-up, so the department would still be involved in doing the rulemaking associated with establishing the biological resource habitat. That was sort of a strategic decision to have the department do that because we already do rulemaking that establishes essential salmonid habitat, and so it would be a similar process, and we have the processes in place, and we would keep the GIS maps online that would make that, you know, those designations available. We would also be involved in whatever a review would occur, you know, multi-agency would occur for applications that came in under the new permitting process that we would be developing with DEQ. So there would be a fiscal associated with the actual development of the new program that's specified by 1530, and so there'd be rulemaking for us to develop a general permit and also to develop an MOA with DEQ to basically delegate the removal fill permit responsibility to DEQ for doing that effort.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to thank you for allowing me to bring these
Absolutely.
Folks up and testify. I really appreciate the opportunity in this busy time frame. Yeah. Thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen. Yeah.
Thank you each. So next we're going to go to
Mr. Chair, I just want to ask mm-hmm. a quick question. When we're asking for a fiscal on this bill, I would hope that we would ask LFO for some type of an evaluation of what the extermination of the in-stream and placer mining industry in Oregon would cost the state from the standpoint of lost income.
Well, as you know, as a member of Ways and Means, those things aren't typically.
Well, I'm sure it'll be indeterminate. But
yeah, I know. We've both asked for those type. I can recall a couple of bills I've asked for similar types of analysis on, and it comes back indeterminate. So, but your point is received and taken. Next, we're going to call up Michael Hunter. If you could come forward and give your testimony, and then we have one final panel, and then we're going to be done with this bill. Oh, I'm going to also announce, if you're here for Senate Bill 1563 for the public hearing on either Senate Bill 1563 or SJM 201, we will not be getting to those today. So we will be carrying those, that Senate Joint Memorial 201 will be carried over to next meeting, as will Senate Bill 1563 carried over to next meeting. So go ahead.
Do you want me to tell the
it's
truth?
Up to, it's up to Senator Olson.
Oh, I didn't have any questions for Mr. Hunter.
He doesn't have questions for you, so you just had to testify.
Okay, good. Yes, oh, yeah, definitely, yeah, definitely. No.
Oh, okay. He does want to do the oath. Okay.
I do.
Under penalty of perjury, will you please raise your right hand? Under penalty of perjury, do you solemnly swear that the evidence you're about to give in the matter now pending before the Senate Environment and Natural Resources Committee shall be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, so help you God?
I do.
Thank you.
Now, Senator Edwards and the rest of the members of the committee here, I attended your meeting on the 4th, and I wrote a rebuttal. Each of you got a copy hand-delivered or in your boxes.
And I would appreciate the summary since...
Okay.
You hadn't signed up at the
I
last
appreciate
meeting.
Being offered and this. I had to try to get it in here because you got such an influx of people. I didn't sign up because there were so many already. I appreciate this. I really do. just a quick summary on this thing. I hear the word supposition, and I hate it. These are allegations. In my little report that I gave to you, there are 20 state and federal millions of dollars of studies that show what suction dredging effect on habitat, fish, and biological everything. These are scientific studies. I have yet to see a scientific study show harm. Nothing in the last 4 years that I've been attending this thing has ever produced one scientific study. There's a difference between a published paper and a scientific study. This attendant that was here on the 4th and stuff had a published paper. I publish every week in our newsletter. Those really are credible. Scientific studies need to be evaluated. Jumping right past that thing, when we're talking about the expansion and that map is totally scary, I'd request the DEQ to actually produce a map that shows where suction dredging is possible. That should take a minute or two is all. I don't think that that map would have any lines on it. Historically, about 1996 when the essential salmon habitat went in, it was limited to more than 20% of any portion of a stream. And that was removed by legislative process. In 96, I'm going to use roundabout figures, there were 3,900 miles of Oregon streams listed as ESH. DEQ meeting 2 years ago, 2012, that figure had advanced to 21,000, from 4,000 to 21,000. Since then, we've done 303 listings, biological research, expanded the scenic waterways, and the DEQ, or the ESL, is even attempting to enhance the navigable waterways by assumption of the 404 from the Corps of Engineers. These are all extreme advances taking more area and encompassing more stream mileage. I want to read a little thing that's listed in here and ask the DEQ how I can justify this. This was from one of their reports. Observation success that placer mining activities conducted in the observed stream systems during the 1997 season did not permanently modify physical habitat characteristics, and data gathered during the 1996, 97, and 98 seasons lend credence to our assumption that no more than minimal adverse effects are resulting from issuing the placer general mining authorization. They've done a total reversal on that now. Mining is totally destructive, and yet in 96, 97, 98, they thought there was no damages. Where is their scientific basis to change their plan? And lastly, during the 838 hearings and stuff, I produced the Federal Department of Interior Fish and Wildlife's coho salmon spawn file, 44 pages if I remember right. I gave that to every member that was involved in 838. And it talked about the mortality. And it listed all of the destructive factors for the coho salmon. That was the one I chose. There were numerous predators and seasonal temperatures and stuff. The biggest single factor is ocean conditions. Not once in 44 pages did it mention mining, suction dredging mining affecting any habitat. This is a huge federal studies that are being ignored. I think those should be taken into consideration. The only issue that we can control in Oregon is human salmon harvest. That means the commercial harvest. And I fished in the ocean for 17 years out of Oregon. So I'm very, very thoroughly aware of salmon harvest. The commercial harvest, the fishermen that's going and catching the mature returning fish are affecting it. Miners in the window, we don't kill a single salmon. We are happy to comply with that window of opportunity where there are no salmon present. Fishing itself is a big destruction. And not only just fishing for the mature return salmon, but we also fish for herring and anchovy. The bait fish that support these fish, we fish those to death too. The ocean is the factor we can't control. Human involvement we can. I appreciate you guys listening to me. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Senator Whitsitt.
Thank you. I do appreciate the bibliography of scientific papers you've provided for us. I haven't got through them all, obviously, but there's some very good papers there. And I would just reinforce what you said, that supposition, allegation, attribution isn't science. It has to be statistically, it has to be reproducible science, and it has to be statistically confident. And for the most part, the studies that we see don't even attempt to show any statistical level of statistical confidence. No calculation of it whatsoever. It's just an observation and a supposition. And it's a sad thing that's happened in science. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Next, Tom Wolf, Kelsey Kopeck, Nathan Donnelly. And this is the last panel, if these folks are here.
Kelsey was not able to make
okay.
it.
Okay.
Chair Edwards, committee members.
Oh, we're going to swear in.
Oh, that's right. Forgot about that part.
Under penalty of perjury, do you solemnly swear that the evidence you are about to give in the matter now pending before the Senate Environment and Natural Resources Committee shall be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, so help you God?
I do. Chair Edwards, committee members, for the record, my name is Tom Wolf, the executive director of the Oregon Council of Trout Unlimited. For brevity, sir, I have already sent an electronic copies of my testimony and some additional scientific studies that have been mentioned by our chief scientist, Dr. Jack Williams. We support this bill. We support the Dash 1 amendments. I am not as familiar with the Dash 2, but I think we will support those. I haven't not read them yet. The one thing I want to add is Dr. Jack Williams is the head of our 20-person science team for Trout Unlimited, and he has his career has been in Southwest Oregon. Before he took the job with Trout Unlimited, he worked for the U.S. Forest Service, first as a fishery scientist, then as a supervisor of the Siskiyou National Forest. He has extensive research on suction dredge mining and the impacts it has. And if you look at the testimony that I have in the sites and what he cites, you can see that we do have concerns about suction dredge mining based on the career of a scientist with almost 40 years of experience in that part of the country. So that's my testimony. Thank you.
Thank you. Go ahead.
Great. Chairman, members of the committee, I'll keep this as brief as possible. My name is Dr. Nathan Donnelly. I'm a scientist at the Center for Biological Diversity and former researcher at the Oregon Institute of Occupational Health Sciences at OHSU in Portland. One particularly negative impact of suction dredge mining is caused by the resuspension and discharge of mercury. Over 56% of suction dredge miners knowingly encounter mercury during dredging operations. While some mercury may be recovered during the mining process, some of it becomes atomized or floured, broken into many tiny bits by the actions of the suction dredge equipment. It is then discharged from the dredge into the river, now in a more reactive form of the heavy metal, which can be methylated, thereby contaminating downstream aquatic and terrestrial food webs. When there's mercury spilled on the floor in a building, the last thing that you should do is clean it up with a vacuum, because as it goes through the vacuum, it volatilizes the mercury into a gaseous or powdered form, distributing it to the surrounding environment and causing a much greater toxicity hazard, even though it appears that most of the mercury that was on the floor is now in the vacuum bag. So that is the advice the US EPA gives on how not to dispose of mercury from compact fluorescent light bulbs. Simply put, vacuuming, whether it's at home or at the bottom of a river, is one of the worst possible ways to collect and dispose of mercury. Many miners claim that they do the state a service by collecting and disposing of mercury and other heavy metals that are left in their sluice after a mining event. Hazardous waste that is not disposed of properly is of much greater concern than hazardous waste that sits untouched, buried under sediment at the bottom of a riverbed. The US EPA does not have random people go and clean up Superfund sites, and the state of Oregon should not allow unlicensed, untrained individuals to clean up and dispose of legacy pollutants. Not only are they putting themselves at risk, but they are likely to make the problem worse than it already is. The gold rush didn't just happen in California, it happened here as well. Gold in Oregon was mined using the same techniques as gold in California, so it's not just California's rivers and streams that have leftover mercury contamination, it's ours as well. The Oregon Health Authority currently has public health advisories on at least 15 water bodies in the state due to mercury pollution in fish. According to the DEQ, 37 water bodies in Oregon are listed as impaired under the Clean Water Act for mercury. An environmental impact report by the California Department of Fish and Wildlife came to the conclusion that, and I'm quoting from the report here, suction dredging has the potential to contribute substantially to, one, watershed mercury loading to downstream reaches within the same water body and to downstream water bodies, two, methylmercury formation in the downstream reaches and water bodies, and three, bioaccumulation in aquatic organisms in these downstream reaches and water bodies. Seemingly low levels of mercury in sediment and water can lead to dangerously high levels in fish that people eat due to the process of biomagnification. A study done by the USGS in 2009 found that biomagnification can result in methylmercury levels in fish that are 2 million times greater than that of the surrounding water. The negative health effects of eating mercury-contaminated fish are profound and can include brain, nervous system, kidney, and immune system damage. Mercury exposure can cause developmental delays and neurotoxicity in children, making women of childbearing age, pregnant women, and children under 17 particularly high-risk populations. Other high-risk populations can include subsistence fishers and hunters and many indigenous populations in the state because they tend to have higher levels of fish consumption than the general population. So to wrap up, the neurological effects of mercury in children are often irreversible. So any accidental or unintended exposure cannot be undone. That is why the decision before you is so important. The failure to protect our waterways from mercury contamination can have serious consequences for the children and other vulnerable populations in Oregon. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions?
Thank you. I actually don't know what particular study you are referring to. I have seen several studies. A couple of years ago, we dealt with the mercury problems, potential or supposed mercury problems. Some of those studies even used canned fish from God knows where. But the question is, do you have any actual empirical evidence of mercury accumulation in any aquatic species caused by suction dredge mining?
Chair Edwards, Senator Whitsitt. I am not aware of any studies that definitively show that suction dredge...
You can finish your answer.
Okay, that suction dredge mining directly leads to higher levels in fish or negative health effects in humans. Those studies are extremely complex. They're very expensive, and they take a long time to get good answers to. You know, chronic disease doesn't happen overnight. It happens over the course of years and decades. And so, you know, we have to rely on what we know now. And what we know from studies done in California is that what comes out the rear end of a suction dredge can have mercury at concentrations that are higher than human health criteria. We know that mercury that can be discharged from the suction dredge and make its way into the water can be converted into methylmercury. And we know that even small increases in methylmercury in water can lead to very high concentrations in fish.
If I could follow up, certainly I wouldn't argue that the potential is there. The potential is there for a lot of things. You know, if you wanted to, we could probably use any different element if you wanted to and find the same or similar. But I'll ask you one further question. I'll leave it alone. Do you know of any study that has actually measured the mercury levels in water downstream of a mercury of suction dredge mining that shows an increased concentration of mercury, or are you just assuming?
So I'm bringing up a lot of studies here. I will direct you to my written testimony. There are studies cited in that. I believe the USGS did look at methylmercury levels before and after a suction dredge event.
Okay, I'd like to see that. Thank you.
Yeah, okay.
Mr. Chair.
Yeah.
Thank you. Just as a little thought of recourse here, did you know that this body required 50% of the lighting in new homes to be compact fluorescent lighting, which contains mercury. So we actually passed a law to put mercury into your house because you had mentioned the fact when that light bulb is bright, don't vacuum it up.
Right.
considering suction dredge mining, mercury is a solid, but it's not a physical, like this box solid. It's liquid. It flows. So you mentioned that the miners dredge it up and they get it in their sluice. How do they do that? Because I believe that it would probably pass through the sluices because it is in more of a liquid form.
Gold and mercury can exist in the environment as an amalgam. So that would be, they would be physically bound together as an alloy. I'm not actually certain of the process of which this, how this goes through the sluice. But sucking up these liquid particles through a high velocity vacuum can cause it to particleize and then become, dispersed throughout the water and make its way into the water body.
One last question, a very short one. Do you know where the highest concentration of fish live that have mercury in them in the state of Oregon?
I do not know that information offhand, no.
Do you live in Portland?
Yes.
Don't go in the river.
Is it the Willamette? Yeah, that was my...
a good guess. Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you both for being here.
Thank you.
Providing your testimony. So that's everybody that signed up and one individual that didn't sign up. Last time, we're going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 1530, and we are going to move into a work session on this bill. So we're going to open up a work session on Senate Bill 1530. And committee members, last public hearing we talked about the dash ones. Senator Bates and Legislative Council presented the dash twos, which addressed a few of the points that were made this meeting about the structure of the bill. And so I would take a motion on the dash ones and then on the dash twos. And then we'll have discussion about those. So,
and Mr. Chair,
yeah.
I move to adopt the dash one amendments dated February 2nd, 2016.
Senator Denbrough has moved to adopt the dash one amendments dated February 2nd, 2016. Is there discussion on the adoption of the dash one amendments?
I have a question, Mr. Chair.
Sure.
Is the dash two amendment dependent on the dash one from the standpoint of is the dash two amendment actually an amended of the dash one amended version?
The way I understand it, and I'm getting a no head nod from Legislative Council, the drafter of this bill, the dash ones are not contained in the dash twos, and the dash twos they can be adopted sequentially because they're not dependent on one another.
Mr. Chair, I thought Ledge Council was supposed to go back to work.
No.
She is.
She's back here to go back to work.
Got her eye on
Mr. Chair, I'd like to make a comment on the dash one. And I believe this is the one that expands the territory. Am I correct on that?
There are several things.
Yeah, I find it rather concerning that we can take a social issue from several years back and turn it into a total ban on the entire state of Oregon to take a class of our residents out of the ability to do what they like to do as a sport. It'd be kind of like telling someone they can't go deer hunting anymore in the entire state of Oregon. And I find that unbelievable that this body would even consider that. I can understand the importance of taking care of our fisheries, of our water, et cetera. Several of the reports I've read had said that there are conclusions that we could make to allow placer miners to go ahead and do that activity. But to ban, to put a moratorium ban on the entire state, to me, seems just to be outlandish.
The comments on the motion on the dash ones. Okay. Seeing no further discussion on the dash ones, are there objections to adoption of the dash ones?
Yes.
Okay, note for the record the objections of Senators Whitsitt and Olson. The motion to adopt the dash ones carries. Now I'd take a motion on the dash twos.
Mr. Chair, I move to adopt the dash two amendments dated February 9th, 2016.
Senator Dembro has moved to adopt the dash twos dated February 9th, 2016. Is there discussion on the motion to adopt the dash twos?
So just what's briefly, I would probably support the dash two if it was, but after adopting the dash one, there's no way to fix the bill, in my opinion, so I'll be a no one.
Any further discussion on adoption of the dash twos? Okay, seeing none, are there any objections to the motion to adopt the dash twos? Note for the record the objections of Senator Whitsitt and Senator Olson. The motion carries. Now I'll take a motion on the bill.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 1530 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that the bill be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference.
Senator Dembro moves Senate Bill 1530 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that it be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference. Let's have some discussion.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Senator Olson.
This is a very large lift. This bill does a lot. And I would think that it would be incumbent upon this body to spend several hours on it, like a long session kind of deal, so we could discuss it, talk about it, work out the appropriate things that would fix it, make it better. I find it very concerning that we're doing it in a short session at such a short time. You've been a great chair on this. You've given everybody an opportunity to speak, but I know there's a lot more people out there that should be able to come and speak about this bill, and I think that this is the wrong time and the wrong place for this bill, considering the fact that if we look at gold prices, they're going up a hair. I don't expect we'll get 2,000 people going out there looking for gold. I would think that there would be a better resolution to this bill than what we're doing.
Thank you for your comments. Senator Dembro?
Yeah, thanks, Mr. Chair. I just want to say, you know, I had the good fortune, I was going to say the dubious fortune, but the good fortune of attending some of the long Senate Bill 838 meetings of the work group, and you know, I have to say I was really impressed by the work that was done there. I was impressed by you know, the goodwill and the you know, productive attitude of the miners who were there, and really came to, you know, a real appreciation of their love of the land. But, you know, I also did hear a lot of, you know, troubling information about the impact of the practice on stream beds, given, you know, things that I knew nothing about, hydromorphology, geomorphology. It was a real learning experience for me. And, you know, especially, you know, if we're concerned about protecting all the, you know, the fish that are in the ocean, the including the lamprey and the mollusks, which, you know, I think, you know, as we heard, are very important to the ecology, and then, you know, also to, you know, our appreciation and respect for the tribes to whom they are very important. You know, those, I think, have to be taken into account when we are, you know, looking at this issue. And I think that's what Senate Bill 1530 does. And, you know, so I'm prepared to send it down to Ways and Means.
Other discussion?
I just have another question. Yeah. Is it intent then that this bill will never see the light of day in a policy committee in the House?
Well, it goes to Ways and Means. You know what the process is, unless a presiding officer requests a hearing, which I believe a presiding officer can do, then it would not be heard in the other chamber.
Thank you for putting that on the record.
Yeah. Are there any further comments or discussion? Okay, seeing none, could you call the roll?
Senator Dembro.
Aye.
Senator Brzozinski.
Aye.
Senator
No.
Chair Edwards?
Yes.
Mr. Chair, before you gavel, yep. I'll give notice of a minority report.
Okay. The intent of the minority report has been notice has been.
Before you gavel, yep. According to our Secretary of the Senate, we need two.
I concur.
Okay. I don't know that our rules allow minority reports in Ways and Means, but we'll note it for the record, and the motion carries. And we are going to close the public or close the work session on Senate Bill 1530. And we're going to open up a work session on Senate Bill 1574. Maureen, if you could come forward and explain the amendment that we have before us.
Way too much stuff. There it is.
Okay, so did I open the work session yet? Okay. So I've opened the work session on Senate Bill 1574. We have an amendment numbered dash dose. The dash twos are before us. The dash twos incorporate the dash ones, which we went through at the last hearing, and then add four-ish to five-ish pieces. And so the intention in my submission of the dash two amendments or that what I asked to be added was that we clarify because I wish Senator Olson was here, but so that we clarify, you know, many of us, you all heard the differences of the numbers that he was reading and the number of affected entities and the numbers that I was reading. And I kept wondering, where is he coming up with these numbers? We got to the bottom of it, and he was using numbers that came from one set of legal analysis that said that the biomass emissions would have been included in the bill, and it had been my assumption, based upon the passage of Senate Bill 752 last session, that biomass emissions, derived emissions, would not have been regulated under this program. And so to clarify that, one of the items that we asked for in the amendment was clarity that biomass-derived emissions would not be included under the regulatory mechanism in the bill. The second item that I asked for was more specific direction for accommodation to emissions-intensive trade-exposed industries. Previously, we had direction to the department and the commission to develop accommodations to address the address leakage. We heard from a number of industries that that was too broad and did not. They were concerned that that specific language was not considered. So I asked that it be considered, or that emissions intensive and trade exposed directive was put into the bill. We also asked for changes to a couple of the committee structures, and I will ask Maureen to go very specifically after I hit the summary points into what those changes are, but including some geographical diversity to a couple of the committees by congressional district and Senate confirmation, particularly to the committees that actually approve disbursement of the funds, and then adding a business person to the one advisory committee, a representative of business. And then finally, in the previous bill, there was a specific directive to push back the inclusion of transportation fuels to 2025, which was when the clean fuels, objectives of the Clean Fuels Program would have been realized. And in talking with a number of folks, that also meant foregoing $300 to $400 million annually of money that would be invested in the transportation system, and would also and could also have a bearing on market liquidity and who's included and who's not. So we figured it'd be best to take that prohibition out and to allow the department to proceed and then, you know, make those recommendations about how to construct the program. So that is the summary of what I requested in the amendment. Maureen, perhaps you could get a little bit more specific.
Yeah, thank you, Senator Edwards, members of the committee. My name is Maureen McGee, and I'm a deputy in the Office of Legislative Counsel, and I was going through my list for testifying today just to make sure that everything that you mentioned is in the amendment, so we got all our bases covered. And what I will do is walk through the Dash 2 amendment. As Chair Edwards mentioned, the Dash 2 amendment does incorporate all of the Dash 1s. And so I think the easiest way to give you very specific direction for the differences between the Dash 1s and the Dash 2s is to go through page by page and point out where the differences are. Before I do that, I did want to make sure and mention that there was one piece of the Dash 1s that I neglected to refer to in my testimony when I was explaining the Dash 1s during the last hearing on this, and that was a change which, if you're looking at the Dash 2s, appears on page 6, lines 6 to 8. And it is a provision clarifying that the requirements for how monies are distributed under the Climate Investments Grant Program that direct 40% of the monies coming out of that grant program to go to disadvantaged communities and 40% to economically distressed areas, that those requirements are not considered mutually exclusive for purposes of that subsection. So that was a change that was in the Dash 1s. It's also in the Dash 2s, but I just wanted to make sure that I mentioned that since I hadn't previously. So the next item, if we're just going back to going back from the beginning, the first difference between the Dash 1s and the Dash 2s, you'll see on page 2 of the Dash 2s, lines 20 through 24. And these are the amendments that remove the prohibition on bringing transportation fuels into the carbon pollution market until the goals of the low carbon fuel standards are achieved. I would note that the Environmental Quality Commission could still delay bringing transportation fuels in, but it leaves it discretionary rather than having a mandate that they could not bring transportation fuels into the carbon pollution market until a date certain. The next difference is on page 3 in lines 12 through 15. This is the leakage piece that Chair Edwards referred to. So this amends the portion of the bill that spoke to allowances distributed to address leakage and makes clear that the Commission shall, in order to address leakage and determined necessary by the Commission, distribute the allowances directly and free of charge to cover entities that include but are not limited to covered entities that are part of an emissions-intensive trade-exposed industry. And I will just note that emissions-intensive trade-exposed industry is not a defined term in the bill.
Mr. Chair?
Yeah.
In that particular section that you just mentioned, mm-hmm. Does that mean they're given free credits? Does that mean they can turn them back in against their pollution, or do they need to pay for them?
It means that they can turn them in against, Chair Edwards and Senator Olson, yes. It means that those are credits that they can use to meet their compliance obligations. The idea behind addressing leakage is that these types of industries are industries that are going to have compliance costs that are going to be very high and that they're going to have a very difficult time passing on, and this and allowing them some level of free allowances in order to help them better comply gives them an opportunity to stay in compliance without being forced by market forces to move outside the state.
So I want to really get this straight. So what you're saying is we're going to give them something for free to entice them to stay in our state, because if we didn't give it to them for free, they would really want to move because they couldn't come up with the cost to comply with us. So we're allowing them to still pollute, but begging them to stay.
If you need to clarify something legally, I would be happy to speak to the intent of what I asked.
Well, I know.
There's
what
a lot of
I know what the I know what
conjecture
the,
in that question.
I know what
so.
The I know what the intent is, and I'm just from the legal standpoint, we are giving them free credits so they'll stay, but yet we're still allowing them to pollute, and they don't have to reduce pollution.
Yeah, and the idea is, as we spoke about in the last hearing, is that until we have a broader scope of regulation that that incorporates broader parts of the nation, all the nation, and international regulation on this, there is always going to be the risk that for those industries for whom, like concrete, cement. Mm-hmm. The cement industry is just like there are process emissions that they cannot get rid of. And so they have really, really high emissions. And when you look at the trade dynamics of that industry, it's the competition from regions that don't have these type of regulatory regimes, could essentially force them out of business. And so that same level of cement production just goes somewhere else, and we haven't done the climate any good. So,
but Mr. Chair, if we give them the free credits, we still haven't done any good. They still get to pollute.
Well, they also have to. I mean, so by having them register and have to have, we know how much it is that they're, what their contribution is to the overall,
True, but if they move out of state, they'll pollute the exact same amount no matter where they're at. So the free credits really, never mind. I understand it.
Good question, Trevor Green.
Yeah.
Is there a definition anywhere in this law or in statute for an emission-intensive trade-exposed industry?
Chair Edwards, Senator Winsett, no, there is not a definition in this bill or elsewhere in statute of emissions intensive trade exposed industries. What I will say is that term, which is sometimes referred to as emissions intensive, sometimes it's also referred to as energy intensive, is essentially a term of art within the world of carbon pricing. And it is a term that refers, again, as I mentioned, to industries where their production of whatever they're producing is highly emissions intensive, meaning that their cost of compliance will be high, but at the same time, they're highly exposed to global competition such that it makes it difficult for them to pass the cost on to their consumers. But you are correct. There is no definition of what that means in this bill.
Yeah.
So would it be correct to say that the definition will be determined by the regulators as to what an emission-intensive trade-exposed industry is?
Chair Edwards, Senator Whitsitt, yes, that would be fair to say. And what I can also just mention, I suppose, is that how this has been handled in California is emissions intensive and trade exposed have been looked at as kind of two separate rubrics for their kind of two separate rubrics for coming up with a grading system for how emissions intensive industry is and how trade exposed it is. They get a score, and between the average of those two scores, there's a determination of how high or low the risk is, that how high or low of a leakage risk they present, and how many f- free credits they should be given.
Is there anything in this bill that requires Oregon regulators to follow the lead of regulators in another state, or can they make up their own definition as they go along?
Chair Edwards, Senator Winsett, that I will need to refresh my memory whether or not there is a specific requirement in the bill that they look to other states. I know for sure that there's a specific requirement or direction in the bill to look to what other jurisdictions have done for setting up the offsets. But in terms of adopting rules for this, for leakage, for example, I can't remember off the top of my head.
I don't believe there is, but continue through the amendment.
Okay, so where was I? All right, so we just spoke about the changes dealing with leakage. The next difference between the dash ones and the dash twos is on page 6 of the, oh, actually, no, that's not the difference. So that was what I was speaking to earlier that was in the dash ones that I had neglected to point out, that disadvantaged communities and economically distressed areas are not considered mutually exclusive for purposes of funding. So on page 8 of the amendment, these are
Marine, some of us are no longer blessed with acute hearing.
Oh, I apologize. page 8 of the amendment. These are some changes to the composition of the Climate Investments and Disadvantaged Communities Advisory Committee. The change is in line 22. The number of members that must be recommended by the Environmental Justice Task Force has been reduced from 9 down to 8, and that is balanced by the addition of a new member that you will see in line 30, and that is one member that must represent the interests of business. On page 10 of the dash 2 amendments, and starting at line 25 and continuing through page 12 of the dash 2s, there's a new section to the bill amending ORS 468A020, and this is the amendment that Chair Edwards referred to ensure, in line with Senate Bill 752 from last session, that the provisions of the carbon pollution market and all related provisions do not apply to carbon dioxide emissions from the combustion or decomposition of biomass. And also on page 10, excuse me, I skipped right over it. At the top of page 10, in lines 2 through 7, there are some adjustments to the structure of the Advisory Committee for the Just Transition Fund. The changes are that the appointments by the governor will be subject to confirmation by the Senate, and that at least one individual from each congressional district in the state must be a member of that advisory committee. And it looks like I skipped over another one on page, so if we jump back on page 6, excuse me for jumping around. On page 6, in lines 13 through 21, there are some changes to the requirements for the composition of the grant committee for the Climate Investments Grant Program. And those changes are that the members appointed by the governor, again, will need to be subject to confirmation by the Senate, and that there will need to be at least one member from each congressional district.
Mr. Chair?
Yeah.
On on line 15,
mm-hmm.
you have written the grant committee may be composed of any number of individuals with qualifications that the governor determines necessary. Could you explain that?
Chair Edwards, Senator Olson, that is broad language for who will be considered members, who can be considered members of the grant committee.
Follow up?
Yeah.
My concern there is that, you know, we're dealing with an extremely complex bill here, and we're dealing with an extremely large amount of money, and there doesn't seem to be anything in this bill that says that somebody has to be able to understand what they're doing, just what the governor determines necessary. So do we have
confirmation?
Pardon?
We have confirmation power.
Confirmation?
Senate confirmation.
Oh, is that what you said? Oh, I'm sorry, I didn't hear you. Never mind.
So, Chair Edwards, Senator Olson, I suppose to just give a full response to that. So the entirety of the language that applies to who is going to be the requirements for appointments to the grant committee is that it will be individuals with qualifications that the governor determines necessary. However, the governor shall appoint at least one member from each congressional district in this state and shall include individuals with experience in administering state grant programs. The appointment of members to the grant committee is subject to confirmation by the Senate. So that is the entirety of the language in the bill that applies to who will be appointed to this grant committee.
And the follow-up?
Yeah, follow-up.
Could you explain to me who would have the background of administering state grant programs unless they actually live or work for the state already? Or do we have people outside of the state that actually administer state grant programs?
Chair Edwards.
That's probably not your expertise.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. We'll get that answered later. Thank you.
Is that it, or continue?
That's it.
Oh, okay.
Those are all the differences between the dash 1 and the dash 2, and I'm happy to answer any other legal or technical questions about the amendments or the base bill.
Okay. Thank you for drafting the amendments, and we are in work session, so you know, I'd love to have a motion on the dash 2 amendments.
Mr. Chair, I move to adopt the dash 2 amendments to Senate Bill 1574, dated February 9th, 2016.
Senator Dembro moves to adopt the dash 2 amendment to Senate Bill 1574, dated February 9th, 2016. Is there any discussion on the motion on the dash 2s?
Mr. Chair.
Yeah.
I've always been skeptical. And when you have come up and you've put the LCFS back in because you can raise $300 to $400 million, it concerns me the fact that you can't put a number on the rest of the bill. And that really bothers me because the $300 to $400 million is going to be 18 cents a gallon for gas. And we did $7.92, that was 4 to 19 cents a gallon for gas. So. I like the Oregonians. I like this on the record that your chair sits there. It's going to add about 40 cents a gallon to your gas tank from now on, and it could go even higher. And it bothers me that in this short session that we take a bill that's so complicated and complex, and it took a long time to get the LCFS through, and DEQ still cannot get it done right yet. It bothers me that we're doing this now when we should have months to work on this. Thank you.
Your objection is noted. Senator Whitson.
Question again with this amendment and the bill when it's moved, I assume going to Ways and Means. Will this bill have another hearing and another public hearing? And two, will it be engrossed before it goes to Ways and Means so that these various amendments can be all seen together in one piece?
It is going to Ways and Means. The second process question, I don't know if it'll be engrossed or not. I would presume that it would be.
I've been requesting
so,
it would be.
I think it is.
Yeah. So I think that's a good request.
Yeah, normally I think those things go down. I mean, that's all the policy committees.
Yeah.
Because whatever we send down there is based on what's been passed out of the policy committee.
Yeah. I'm trying to recall any policy bills when I was chairing the natural resources sub that I got that weren't engrossed. So I think that that's standard procedure, but I think that we should follow up and make sure that it is.
With respect, it kind of depends on how late in the session it is.
So.
And we're already late in the session, so that's why my request. I mean,
okay. Fair enough. Any other discussion on the dash twos? Okay. Yep. Yeah.
I think Senator Wissett also asked the other question.
That's 2 weeks before the
regarding public testimony. Senator Wissett, I also heard you ask the question about public testimony.
Yes.
I believe there will be more, at least in Ways and Means, through that process.
But be invited or open testimony?
That's not for us to control. We're not the co-chairs of the Ways and Means. But my understanding is that they do have testimony down there.
In my subcommittee, we always did, but so.
Again, I mean, there's a difference between invited testimony
sure.
and public testimony.
Sure. Fair enough.
As you well know.
Yeah. Any other discussion on the dash twos? Okay, seeing none, are there objection to adoption of the dash two amendments? Note for the record the objections of Senator Whitsitt and Senator Olson. And that motion carries.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 1574 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that the bill be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference.
Senator Denbrough moves Senate Bill 1574 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that it be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference. Is there any discussion on the motion?
Mr. Chair.
Yeah.
You know I always have a few words to say. I'll start with 0.25%. That's our carbon dioxide output in the world. 0.25%. This bill obviously understands that it's going to be a tremendous impact on people because it actually puts money into where we can help people pay their bills. We will have, there is in process, a bill to eliminate coal from electrical generation, which is going to raise our rates. And we've heard from those companies, and they said it could be up to 2% increase. This bill will also raise our rates. And so we've got a fee. My concern is that can Oregonians handle or be capable of paying for what we're doing to them? And I think the answer is no, because this bill clearly says no. It says we're going to take money from people and we're going to give it to other people that can't afford to pay what we've just done. And I think that's appalling to ever run a bill like that through our system. And that's my objection.
Fair enough. Is there further discussion on the motion on the bill? I guess I'm surprised we don't have more discussion, but fair enough. I know. I respect what you said, Senator Olson, and obviously we have fundamental disagreements about the issue, and I hope that I'm not mischaracterizing your position in saying that we have a disagreement about whether or not Oregon has an obligation to do its part. As I said before, as I've said many times, I thought years ago that we would have gotten further down this road on a national level, and we haven't. It becomes harder and harder to accomplish our greenhouse gas reduction goals, if that is something that matters to one, as it does to me. It becomes harder and harder to do that the further we delay action. And I think that this bill, more than any in a long time, takes the biggest step in starting that process and giving some certainty. And unlike other bills, creates a mechanism by which we can actually also start taking adaptation and resilience measures. And there just aren't any other approaches that I've seen out there that are on the table that allow our communities to do that and provide a funding source for that. So that is why I am partial to this approach. Obviously, there is another big bill that's out there floating around, and I think it was heard this afternoon in the House. I don't know what I don't know if it was worked or not, but and I don't know what's happened with it, but I don't know if it's going to Ways and Means or if it's coming over to a policy committee. I've heard different stories about that. So there are a lot of decisions to make, and this is just the first step on this bill. There are a lot of decisions for the legislature to make in the next couple of weeks. Senator Whitsitt.
Well, I do respect your position. I disagree with it. I respect
sure.
it. My concern is that this bill or the low carbon fuel standard or the renewable portfolio standard as applied to Oregon will make no measurable difference in global emissions of greenhouse gases. And if we're assuming that China and India and Malaysia and Indonesia and Africa are watching what's happening here today and are going to follow suit, then it might make, I might believe it would be useful. I don't believe they're watching. I don't believe they care. And I think all we're doing is unilaterally hurting Oregon.
Mr. Chair, I do.
Yeah.
If I could just respond to that, because it is an important issue. I do believe that the action that we'll be taking in passing this bill, will make a difference in the global effort to deal with carbon pollution. And, you can look at it in a number of ways. Yes, we are a federal system and we make decisions state by state. But the actions that a state takes influences other states. Every day when we take action to try to solve a problem, we look to other states to see what their experience has been. Have problems resulted from the decisions that they've made? Were there unintended consequences? What can we do in order to allay those consequences, when we take it up? The fact is that the action already taken by California and British Columbia on the West Coast, and it's being contemplated on, in Washington. If we were to join them, we would be a large part of the world's economy that would be taking action to appropriately price carbon. And so, I think there really is value to it. If we can do that and join the New England states and Quebec, there is momentum that I think can move this forward. And I think it's really an important step that we're taking today. Thank you.
Any other discussion on the motion? All right. Seeing none, could you call the roll?
Senator Dumbrow.
Aye.
Senator Pozanski.
Aye.
Senator Whitsitt.
No.
Vice Chair Olson.
No.
Chair Edwards.
Yes.
Mr. Chair.
The motion carries.
Yeah. Intent to file a minority report.
Okay. Note for the record, Senator Olson's and Senator Whitsitt's intention of filing a minority report. With that, the motion carries. The bill is on its way to Ways and Means. We will close the work session on Senate Bill 1574. And then we have carried over, as noted earlier, we're carrying over the possible work sessions on Senate Bill 1517, 1563, the public hearing on Senate Bill 1563, and the public hearing on SJM 201. Those have all been carried over to our next meeting, and with that, we are adjourned. Adjourned.